Welcome to NeuroStories, the podcast that highlights the people behind neuroscience at the Walton Centre. Together, we will lift the lid on the complex worlds of neurology and neurosurgery and everything in between, hearing fascinating tales of the incredible staff and services carried out in the hospital every day.
Yes. Door is open.
Dr. Anita Krishnan. I'm a consultant neurologist. I've also got a clinical managerial role, so I'm the divisional clinical director for the neurology division. And the neurology division at the Walton Center includes neurology as a specialty, but also other specialties, so neuroradiology, neurophysiology, neuropsychology, psychiatry, and then we have got some rehabilitation medicine and similar.
Why neurology for you?
Oh, that goes back a very, very, very long time. So we're talking about, my God, I don't mind giving my age away. I'm in my mid-50s. So when I was, when I started medical school, so this is sort of 18, 19, and I did medical education in India. We had some very, very brilliant and charismatic neurologists. So you know how you sort of hero worship sometimes certain sort of teachers or you know, professors and so on. But there was something about neurology which was always extremely sort of enticing. But at the same time, it was a difficult field. So in medical school, if you were, when you were going for exams, it was invariable that you would have a neurology, what's called as a long case. So the main case you are examined on would be one of the main specialties, and one of them would be neurology. So we had a bit of that fear element, as well as we had such good teachers. And so I suppose I've always had an interest in that. And then from there branched into neurology. It's very, lots of medicine is analytical, but also a lot about, you know, pattern recognition. It's very, very much exemplified in neurology. There's a very defined pattern recognition. You still can use a lot of clinical skills and figure out what's happening, though the external opinion might be, gosh, they're doing hundreds of scans and tests. The clinical opinion of when I see a patient, hear their story, examine them, still matters significantly in neurology.
And what was it like in those early days? What was it like studying in India?
Oh, gosh. So obviously, you know, college, medical college is probably some of the best years of my life. You know, at that time, probably we would not have thought so, but you had a group of friends, you had a degree of independence that was great. And I think those still dominate. And it's even more so now that we have all these reunions. So I've just come back from the 35th year reunion of my batch.
Wow.
And we were 150 of us, and 131 of us attended this one.
Wow, that's a great turnout.
It is. And obviously, at that point in time when we started, obviously, we had our skirmishes and we didn't get along with everybody. But now we're all great friends. We've all grown, you know, older, matured, become more, you know, and you sort of see how much. So what is it that keeps us together? It's those 5 years that we spent together in college. And that is just amazing. In India, things are different. I mean, our undergraduate education, I think, was exemplary. The teachers that we had who taught us basic things in medicine, which is things like anatomy and the physiology of how the human body works and all those, they were extremely good. And hospitals, of course, are very, very crowded and busy. We have people in the corridors, on the, you know, everywhere, on beds, sometimes on the floor, etc. Because there are two things, isn't it? It's the population is so large. Just the small part of the state in India where I come from is as big as the UK.
Wow.
Other than the population is sort of the economic issues, it's, you know, quite significantly low. So busy times, but that just means that you gain a lot of experience. Nothing teaches you medicine more than spending time on the ward, seeing patients and doing the same thing over and over again.
Repetition.
Absolutely.
The people skills of a busy hospital.
You never get that in classrooms or listening to lectures or, you know, listening to somebody just, you know, talking about it. You learn things by seeing, and you learn things by making initial errors, and then somebody saying, that's not how it's done, this is the way you do it, and it'll always stick with you. The more time you spend on the wards, I do think that you actually do become a, you know, more accomplished clinician, and you've got better skills at hand. It's, again, a lot all about practice and pattern recognition.
And so how did you go from India to the Walton Centre? How did you move to the UK?
It's a bit of an odd story. So a lot of people may not know. I actually grew up in the UK when I was a child. So early 70s, when there was a big move for the NHS to get doctors from India. So my mother is a doctor. She's a paediatrician. And so they were actually interviewed and asked to sort of come and work in the NHS. So between the ages of sort of 3 and 5, we were actually in Yorkshire. So I've got great memories of my time there. And then we went back to India. So my mom, all of us moved back. Then I went through, obviously, college education and all of that. And I had no plans of coming to the UK. But once I finished my medical degree, one of the things that always sort of thing was, it'd be good to get my MRCP, because in India also, it does matter about how much experience you have, but also in terms of an external degree has got great value. And so my only aim was, I'll come to the UK, work towards my MRCP, and then go back again and work in India.
Sorry, what's an MRCP?
An MRCP is a member of the Royal College of Physicians. So that's one of the, you know, it's actually one of the basic exams that you do while you are progressing through your medical career here. Things so happened that I also met my husband at that time, who was also here for his set of exams. So we got married. It's slightly odd. So at that point, we said, okay, we'll continue here, work a bit longer. And then one thing led to another, and that's it. And that's 26 years ago.
It's funny how those happen, isn't it? Isn't how it just falls into place sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, all my family is in India. I visit very frequently. Initially, when we were here, travel and all that was not possible because you're in very busy junior doctor jobs. We could only go home once every 2 years or 2.5 years. But now in this stage of life that I'm in, it's much more. My son has grown up, he's gone to university, got a bit more time. I don't have to rely on school holidays, so I don't have to wait for that.
Yeah.
And so I tend to travel whenever I get some time. I tend to find an off-peak ticket and fly to India and come back.
So what does a day at the Walton Centre look like for you?
My current job, I think it'll be an understatement if I say it's a busy job. So I have a clinical role, and then I've got the managerial role, and both of them are quite busy. I do 3 clinics a week, 2 of them at Walton, 1 of them at my, what I call as a peripheral hospital. Mm. So the structure of the Walton is all neurologists. We work for 2 or 3 days at the Walton, and the other 2 days in the week, we'd go to a neighboring hospital and see patients there in a clinic, as well as see any inpatients there with neurological problems who are referred. So my district general hospital is Halton and Warrington. Prior to that, it used to be Arrow Park. So if I were to go take you through a working week, there'll be Monday, it's primarily time for me to do letters and do my admin work, as well as have meetings, etc. From my managerial role. Then when I'm on my clinics come, so each clinic is a 4-hour one, so that you'll see patients, which will either be most of them face-to-face, sometimes video. I specialize in headache and disorders that cause changes in pressure within the brain. So most of the patients that I need to see tend to be face-to-face. And then some of the treatments that we give, we do obviously injections and so on. It all needs to be face-to-face. Of the 4 days I spend at the Walton, 2 clinics, and the other 2 days is a mixture of clinical and managerial things. And loads of people have access to my diary. My diary gets filled pretty quickly with various meetings of various sorts. And so my clinical managerial role, well, a lot of it is talking to colleagues and seeing whether you can sort out issues or difficulties that they are facing either within their department or between their department and somebody else. A lot of it is about listening to people and talking through that. A big chunk of my role is governance. So when things go wrong, examining why did they go wrong, what could have been done better, what are the lessons learned. And arising from governance, there'll be loads of different meetings that come up where we have to discuss these things. You know, I'll have to do investigations trying to see whether something, you know, what else could have been done and so on. And the other part of my role is service development. So each of the specialties that I represent, obviously, none of us can work in silos. It's a collaborative work. Sometimes that's very difficult to see, because when you are not in a manager's role, you might think, oh, I can protect my service and my specialty and my clinic. And we would think like that. And I used to think like that before I became a clinical manager. Then your eyes do get opened a bit. Like, you then start looking at viewing things, thinking, well, it's not just my department, my clinic, my role. There are other colleagues all in a similar situation. So if I want a new facility or a medication commission for my group of patients, so do all the other specialties for theirs. And therefore, hospital trusts have got this not very enviable task of constantly juggling around things to try and figure out who's got the priority, how do we go about it, you know, what's the list of things that we need to achieve in this period of time, and so on. So a lot of those sort of service related things takes up, I suppose, the rest of the role. It is a good mix. Obviously, I've been a neurologist for a long time, and a lot of people sometimes don't factor this in. But once you've been doing something for a very long time, believe it or not, even in neurology, boredom creeps in. And whenever I say this to medical students, just for them to be aware of this prospect 10, 15 years down the line of their career, they all look slightly shocked, because clearly everybody goes into it with enthusiasm. But you should always make sure that you've got other interests, I suppose, that you can divert out to, so that it doesn't get all mundane and boring.
Neurology is your bread and butter, isn't it?
Yes.
And you as a doctor.
That's me primarily. I am a neurologist. Yes, I'm not a manager primarily. I'm a neurologist.
And you said about that service development, and that is very much in the form of RANA, isn't it? The rapid access to neurological assessments.
Yeah,
that, you know, that's where you've been able to take that, right, my neurology is there.
Yeah.
It's ticking over.
Yeah.
What else brain space have I got for? And obviously RANA was one of those, wasn't it?
As you know, it was born initially out of a need during COVID to try and be collaborative and helping the system of that was the other hospitals and how we can help from our point of view. And obviously, that's now become an integral part of our service. And the model has been quite rightly commended by various different groups, both locally as well as nationally. In RANA, we would, you know, what we're doing is seeing patients who present to A&Es and neighboring sort of acute medical departments. They've got a new neurological problem. They are well enough. An immediate life-threatening issue is not the problem there, in which case they would have been admitted to the hospital, but they do need a quick neurology opinion rather than going on a waiting list to be seen after, you know, a few weeks or a few months. Patients can be referred to RANA. We then look through the referrals, make sure they're appropriate for RANA, and then see the patients within 48 to 72 hours. Or in some cases, we are able to advise and say, actually, this patient is already under this neurologist, and we can actually provide this advice and so on. So
really clearing out that pathway for some patients. It's really sort of streamlining it, isn't it?
Yes. And it has been primarily very, very much of help to the patients who go through that, as well as to the hospitals who, you know, where the patients initially presented. And as you rightly said, it is the right thing to do. And where we are able to do that, you know, everybody's under pressure, different parts of the service. We can do this bit to help and collaborate with the rest of the thing. That's always quite useful.
What's the most rewarding part of your job?
The rewarding part of a job, okay. So it's almost always people who appreciate the work you put in. So whether it's a patient telling you, thank you so much, I can see that you've really taken good care of me, or you've gone out of your way to find out what's wrong with me, or you've always been just listened to me. So many patients will say that, you know, you've listened to me, and thank you so much. And it's a similar thing, I suppose, from a managerial point of view, when you get that feedback to say, look, this is the input you provided, and it really worked for our group or our department. That is the rewarding part.
So the next section is a quick fire round.
Right.
Ready?
Okay. Yes, go on.
What would you be if you weren't a neurologist?
Teacher.
Teacher?
Yeah.
Subject?
English.
What's your biggest hobby?
My biggest hobby is reading. Cooking as well, cooking different cuisines.
So that brings me on to favorite book.
It's one that's called The Physician by Noah Gordon. Now, if you actually think it's all medical related, it's actually almost historical about medicine. But that's, it's been an inspirational book for me.
Favorite song?
I tend to primarily listen to Indian classical and sort of Bollywood songs rather than things. So maybe one amongst those.
Favorite film?
Film, oh my God. I can watch the Matt Damon series any time of the day or night.
The Bourne Legacy ones? Spy films?
Yes, any time you put that on, I will watch it.
Favorite animal?
A dog, any day, yes. Strangely, I don't have one now. That's because, believe it or not, I'm rarely at home because I mostly at work, but yeah, dogs.
Dead or alive, who would you most want to have a drink with or take to dinner?
Oh gosh, this is a difficult one. I can't even think of, I don't know why the first name that popped to my mind was Barack Obama, but that I'll go and stick with that. Excellent. Yeah, I think it'll be an excellent conversation with him.
That'd be fascinating to have dinner with Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Food you love?
Oh, it's a South Indian thali. It's my home cuisine, but not North Indian food that is generally served in the UK, but South Indian, and it is yummy.
What is that?
So a South Indian thali is basically a spread of, we are primarily rice based, so that'll be the main thing, but you'll have multiple different vegetables and sort of dal, lentil based things, mostly vegetarian. And I am vegetarian, but I'm saying in South India, there's a sort of higher trend of being vegetarian. But yeah, that's it, any day.
Sounds delicious.
Yeah.
Food you hate?
Do you know what? Some strange reason, I'm not into Thai food. I don't know why that is. Not my favorite.
Who's your hero?
My hero will be my mother. She's shown me how to live life under difficulty, okay? So it has not been at all easy for her. And also to sort of deal with imperfections. I think that's how I put it.
Amazing. Best thing to happen to you?
My son. Yeah, it's probably a cliche, but you bring up a child and he's an amazing little kid who's 21 years old and 6'4" tall, so little kid. But we have the best time together and we've got it. And I think it changes a lot of your perspective in life and it makes you, I think, more patient. I think I was a bit less grounded before that, but yeah. And he keeps me totally grounded, totally.
How has neurology changed over the course of your career?
Gosh, I mean, it's amazing how much it has, So when I started training in neurology, so this is, I'm talking about the late 90s, and we had the understanding about medical, certain neurological conditions and what we could do and the treatments we could offer. Compared to that, now, 25 years down the line, what is available is just stupendously different and large. And that just comes from research that has gone into it. So for almost every illness, we've got a much more streamlined, targeted therapy. Previously, we would say, okay, we could use this and see what happens. But now it's like, we've got this therapy that actually treats this particular receptor on this cell, which is involved in this disease. And so it is, so much more targeted. That does mean that we've got so many more options to give patients. That does mean that it does take up a lot more time. I'm not saying, with choice also comes its own challenges, doesn't it? And then, but it's a much, better system to have rather than previous. Previously, one of the criticisms about neurology was that, oh, even if you guys make fancy diagnosis, what's the point? You don't have any medications to give them. But now, people can't say that because it's very, very different. And this is only going to expand. So, the way it is going, we are going down targeted treatments, gene therapy. So I think treatment strategies and how we manage conditions is what's going to change significantly as we go forward.
And are there any like milestones? Are there any things that have happened over those, like you said, those 25 years where you think, wow, that's a game changer?
It's happened in every field in neurology, you know, Sam. I don't think we can sort of list one thing as, you know, the main thing. And I would sort of say the two things are sort of expanding therapies and also the fact of how we monitor. So the collection of data about various illnesses or diseases, and then how we use that to guide our treatments. You know, that what's called as evidence-based medicine. That's another thing that's, you know, become the backbone of things. We used to do it in much less robust ways, I think, before, and before I'm talking about 20, 25 years ago. Mm. But that's much more ingrained in the system now, and therefore that then guides everything that we do. We're sort of saying it's based on this data, this evidence, this study, this trial. Mm. It's not based on, let's try this and see whether it works. It's not the, you know, the policy anymore.
Yeah, so it's very thoughtful, very based on evidence.
Yeah,
fantastic. What are you excited for the future of neurology?
We're constantly trying to enthuse, you know, young trainee doctors to actually take up neurology. Previously, it used to be almost very much just neurology registrars rotating through, but now we've got groups of medical trainees who are sort of in the early stages of medical training come through neurology. So we're trying to sort of expand that knowledge. Got to understand that everything in neurology is not fancy stuff. You've got very simple, very, very common conditions that happen. For example, headaches is one of the most common things. You know, people having blackouts, tingling and numbness. These are all very, very common things that is not just within the remits of a neurologist to treat and sort. It should be within the sort of the knowledge base of the GP and the medical practitioners, etc. It's like the common example that I give is if you have an allergy, okay, you're not going to wait to see an allergy specialist to start its treatment. You know, there's basic common knowledge there about allergies, what we can avoid. The GP can give you, you know, advice. Mm. The practice nurse can. So conditions like headache has to sort of fall into that. There's sometimes this unrealistic or expectation that everything has to be sorted out in neurology. But yeah. So expanding that knowledge out there, that's quite important. So we do need more people buying into the idea of neurology rather than it remaining as one of those, oh, it's a very niche thing that only some people do. Of course, there is some aspects of neurology, what we call as very specialist, highly specialized neurology, that has to be under the remits of neurologists. So along with thinking, okay, there's a lot of expansion that's happening in terms of treatment and the highly specialist one, we shouldn't forget the common ground neurology, which has to come under everybody's remits.
Yeah. So what would your key takeaways be then for anyone listening to this episode?
Right. Okay. So on a, I can sort of talk about it from a professional front and from a personal front. From a professional front, I would encourage anybody who's listening to this to say that if it be it a trainee, be it somebody who's just interested in neurology or somebody who's just listening for the, you know, because they've sort of chanced upon this, that neurology is a specialty of, you know, like many other things of, you know, significant different halves. And you've got the highly specialist ones, as well as what I call as, you know, the common ground neurology. It's a very interesting field. If you want to train in it, there are plenty of opportunities. And if you want to learn more about it, there's so many dedicated, you know, information sources, websites, our Walton Center website itself, as well as many others, you know, to get information from. From personal front, what I'd like to tell people is, again, oh gosh, the journey's been amazing. I do think that, and this is going to sound very cliched, you know, I'm not a highly intelligent or brilliant person. I'm just of, you know, average intellect is how I would define myself. The moment somebody hears that you're a neurologist, they'll say, oh, you're a brainy doctor. And I'll say, well, I am good in neurology. There are some things that I'm terrible at, you know, like computers or fixing things at home or whatever. But then the important thing is, you know, is much more than your knowledge base. It's your interaction with people and how you communicate, that decides your success in life? And I know that sounds like a broad, sweeping statement, but I do firmly believe in it. You don't have to be, you know, gold medalist, top of the class, you know, thing to become a successful doctor. What you need is to be able to really interact well with people, see both sides of the story. That's another important thing. And to doctors who are already in the field, I'll strongly advise them at some point in their lives to take on a clinical managerial job. When I initially was encouraged to do this, I thought, gosh, these people must be totally off their rocker, because I had no interest in, you know, being a clinical manager. And what this has taught me, of all its ups and downs, because people see this as a, gosh, why would I want to do that? It's taught me far more about myself than anything else has, because you are put into situations which are initially unfamiliar to you. It's a huge learning curve. You actually learn to interact with people. I used to think I was brilliant at communication even before, but now when I do this, I realize, well, there were some things where I was only seeing my viewpoint. I wasn't seeing the other side of the story. Now you learn to see the other side of the story. You learn a high degree of compassion and empathy. You learn not to lose your temper too quickly and not to be too quick to judge people. And that way, I think it's given me lots of life skills. And I really would advise people, initially settle yourself into your medical career, but at some point, take on a lead role, take on the, you know, the becoming either the clinical lead, the educational lead, the governance lead, and you'll realize that it does add a significant dimension to your life.
Thank you for listening to NeuroStories. You can listen to more episodes on Spotify and stay up to date with the latest news and events from the hospital on our social media channels at The Walton Centre on Facebook and Instagram and at Walton Centre on X. Got feedback? Email the communications team at wcft.communications@nhs.net. This podcast was recorded, edited and hosted by Sam Fleet from The Walton Centre's communications team.